Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thank you for coming. This is a very important topic, and we're so excited at Blue Shield to be sponsoring this today. So welcome to the Commonwealth Club. My name is Teresa Faye Bustillos, and I'm the Program Director of the Blue Shield of California Foundation. We're really pleased to support tonight's program. You know, Blue Shield has been addressing the issue of domestic violence for over 16 years. We've given over $100 million to this issue, so we take this really seriously. And this is a part of our overall commitment and mission to make California the healthiest state and end domestic violence. That's actually our mission at the Blue Shield of California Foundation. We're also a sponsor and supporter of the Commonwealth Club because we think these conversations are so important and valuable to have these kinds of sessions and incredible speakers like we have. So tonight we have three women who are passionate, knowledgeable about ending domestic violence and sexual assault, because at the end of the day it is about that, and asking tough questions about why we haven't made more progress. We're honored to have with us Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who represents District 14, which includes the southern portion of San Francisco and most of the peninsula. Since 2008, Representative Speier has advocated for women's rights throughout her time in Congress, as well as her 20-plus years prior to the California legislature. I was backstage listening to all the incredible things she has done. I can't say them all right now, or we would spend the whole time talking about her. Among her many efforts, Congresswoman Speier has fought and continues to fight for the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, reforms to close the gender pay gap, and an end to sexual assault in the military and on college campuses. We're also honored to welcome Susie Loftus, former president of the San Francisco Police Commission and current assistant chief legal counsel to the San Francisco Sheriff Department. Susie is a native San Francisco who used her time at the San Francisco Police Commission to improve police response in cases of violence against women. Susie has also served as assistant district attorney specializing in cases of domestic violence. And again, backstage, listening to the cases that she's represented, she is very, very knowledgeable about this work. Our third is led by activist, writer, professional, feminist, I love this, amateur woman. I didn't get to ask her what that meant, but I kind of related to it. Chicana, mother, and partner, Cristina Escobar. Cristina has been an avid advocate for women's rights and critical observer of how women are portrayed in the media. She has a great blog that I discovered in kind of researching her. She has worked in many different capacities, including prior positions at Break the Cycle, a national domestic violence prevention agency, and the Representation Project, an organization committed to overcoming society's limiting stereotypes. We're excited and privileged to have these women here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Congresswoman Jackie Speier, Susie Loftus, and Cristina Escobar to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Good evening. As Teresa just said, I'm Cristina Escobar, writer, activist, and former deputy director of Break the Cycle, and I'm excited to be moderating tonight's important conversation here at the Commonwealth Club. We're joined tonight by Congresswoman Jackie Speier and Susie Loftus, legal counsel to the San Francisco Sheriff's Department. So let's get started. I want to start with something that maybe seems a little basic, but I do think is important, which is, what is domestic violence? I find that our society tends to tell a single story about intimate partner abuse. You can picture it. A 35, 40-year-old woman, she's married with kids, she's getting physically assaulted by her husband, and she's some sort of victim type. She's got low self-esteem, not what you would call strong. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, first of all, domestic violence is about power and control. It's not always physical. Sometimes it's financial, economic, emotional. And whenever there are children involved, it complicates the situation even more, because there's fear of danger to the child if the spouse leaves.
And then in the context speaking in my experience as a domestic violence prosecutor, it's also an additional element, really any crime done in the context of an intimate partner relationship is its own crime, right? So an assault with force, likely to cause great bodily injury is in and of itself its own crime, but it's an additional crime, and there's a additional element when it's someone who you're in a relationship with. I think we've also seen it's a crime that can grow and expand as there's other ways that you can exert control and harm to someone you love. It can include animal abuse. If an animal is something that's really important to you, we're seeing new ways that abusers are expanding their control and power to hurt what you love. And oftentimes that can be an animal as well.
Yeah. I find one of the problems with the myth is that it makes some people feel like domestic violence is not going to happen to them, that it doesn't happen in their communities or with their people. But we actually know that domestic violence is one of the rare societal problems that is sort of equal opportunity. It can happen to anyone regardless of socioeconomic status or whether you're part of a marginalized racial group. Why do you think that is, and what are the sort of exceptions to that rule?
Well, the exception would be for people of color and trans and LGBT members who have an incidence of domestic violence that's two times that of the rest of the population. I think that we have a cooked-in bias that what happens in the home is just an interaction that is not subject to the law. It took forever mm-hmm. for law enforcement to be trained to recognize that it was indeed a violation of the law. And then when they realized that, it became some of the most dangerous calls that they were sent on because they are so easily explosive in nature.
Yeah, that's right. I tell this story because I think there's hope at the end of it. I will say this, of what's possible in 30 plus years. Because this, what I'm about to say is hard to hear, but when I first started on the San Francisco Police Commission, one of the most senior folks who had been in the department for a long time, he said to me, we were looking at how we could better investigate domestic violence and how we could better support victims. And he said, Susie, it's the weirdest thing. When I started on the job, we used to just knock on the door and say, keep it down. And this is someone who, retired within the last 10 years from the police department. And so I think the hope in that, right, is that in that period of time with the Violence Against Women Act and advocates on the federal level and the state level, and it's all community-based organizations, it's all shelters, it's all women, it's aunts, mothers, this, to the extent to which we've ever found a solution to this problem, it is a grassroots, women and community supporting each other and then recognizing, and what we have to do is train law enforcement and train judges so that they see maybe something in a different way, something that they did not expect. And the laws have had to catch up with what was happening. And we recognize what we can do when we're all working together on something.
Yeah, I love that you brought up the Federal Violence Against Women Act. It was passed in 94, and since then we've seen a dramatic drop-off in rates of domestic violence against adult women. But in young women in high school, college, shortly out of college, we haven't seen a drop-off. What is it about these relationships that's keeping them from our policy interventions, keeping it from working? What's different, and why haven't we made progress there yet?
What a question. I guess my mic isn't working, so they're suggesting that I use this.
There you go.
Okay, am I live? Okay. So, first of all, VAWA was a great improvement. We've seen a 67% decrease in the number of incidents of domestic violence as a result of that law being enacted. And it has always been a bipartisan piece of legislation in Congress, always, until this year. Mm-hmm. And this year, we have been unable to pass an extension of VAWA. So we did a two-month extension, and it really fell along party lines, ironically. But I would say that the reason why it's not seen as domestic violence when it's sexual assault among young people is that we have a different code. For instance, it exists in schools and in universities. There's a code of conduct that allows them to operate, frankly, outside the law. It's what we see in the military system as well, where there's 20,000 rapes a year, mostly of men, I might add. But it's because you have a uniform code of military justice. So the fact that you can operate outside of the criminal law of all society is, I think, part of why we have not placed enough emphasis on the issues, particularly in high school and college campuses.
Yeah, and I think we have to take the gains of what we learned with the sharp decrease in domestic violence against adult women. But one in three, you know, the Futures Without Violence statistics are that one in three adolescents are going to experience physical, sexual, or verbal abuse in a dating relationship. So as a mother of three daughters, I have a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 9-year-old. I have, what do they say, I've got a lot of skin in this game. So many of us do, that we're failing young women and young people. And I think some of the lessons that have been really done well, you guys should check out if you haven't already, loveisrespect.org. You know, there's been this idea that we weren't reaching young people and talking about what safe, healthy relationships were. And I think that that's really important because it looks different. I mean, we can all talk about just how dating has changed. I'm going to date myself and, you know, but people meet and interact and communicate in different ways, on phones, on social media. And so the campaigns and the effort to educate, you know, we think that judges didn't understand an abusive relationship in the context of a marriage. Now add, you know, a federal judge or a judge who's been on the bench for a long time understanding the dynamics of a DM on Twitter, you know, because apparently that's a thing someone had to brief me on. Mother of three. And so I think that part of it is meeting victims where they are and taking the gains of the movement that we do know it's about collaboration. It's about setting the table with law enforcement, with judges, with advocates. It's about training. It's about accountability. And we can make progress. And we certainly have a tremendous amount of work to do when it comes to young women and young people.
Absolutely. You know, physical and sexual abuse are both crimes in many cases, but emotional and financial abuse sometimes are not. That being said, they can be just as insidious, just as damaging. How do we get better at recognizing these forms of violence and taking them more seriously?
Well, they're all defined as potentially domestic violence. So I think that again, educating our jurists is probably, you know, the best way that we can guarantee that those forms of violence will be considered. But let me talk about the elephant in the room for a minute. The vast majority of those who serve in elective office are men. It's 80%. And we had the Year of the Woman back in 1992, on the heels of the Anita Hill hearings in the Capitol, in the Judiciary Committee. And I happened to be at home recovering from a procedure. And I remember watching that hearing and throwing my slipper at the TV. So the truth is, not a whole lot has changed in terms of who is calling the shots. And we saw that in the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, particularly on the Republican side, where you know two of the members were octogenarians, for God's sakes. And after Dr. Blasey Ford testified, they said things like, well, she was attractive. Her testimony was attractive. So until we change the makeup of our legislative bodies, until they're more equitable in terms of representation, frankly, I think we're going to be fighting this uphill battle, because I see the retrenchment that's going on now with Title IX, where the universities were being held accountable under the last administration. Under this administration, and now the most recent release by Betsy DeVos, who's the Secretary of Education, I mean, the tables are, or I should say that the justice is, the thumb of justice is being based more on the perpetrator and not the victim. Because now she wants to raise the standard, and there is this presumption that women somehow are coming forward and making claims that aren't true. And the National Center for Sexual Violence Research has looked at all kinds of documentation from, you know, local law enforcement and studies that have been done. 92% to 97% of those who come forward with a sexual assault charge are telling the truth. So the fact that we have, you know, the president who said Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony was compelling and then subsequently was trashing her as a victim sends a huge message to women everywhere. So again, the numbers have to change in our legislative bodies to really get the kind of equity we want to see.
And I would offer, I agree 100%, and I would argue that we also need to see diversity in law enforcement, in judges, in every actor who makes a decision in the process. My experience of being a prosecutor, I had all three of my kids while I was serving as a prosecutor, and I found I was prosecuting domestic violence during my second pregnancy. And as soon as I started showing, I found, like, with victims and survivors going through the worst time of their life, and then also being part of a system that, even on its best day, is not particularly responsive to the needs of a survivor, particularly of domestic violence. And my job was to hold her hand, and sometimes it was men, hold their hand through the process. When I started showing and I was this pregnant prosecutor, all of a sudden it was like we had a connection. We had a shared experience. They saw me in a way that they didn't see me up until that moment. And then when we really saw each other, that's when we could build the trust that you need to say, we can do this, and here's why, and here's how this is going to happen. And so I think that it's this idea of diversity, not as a box that we check, but truly as a source of our strength. So when we're looking at these movements and how we want to change things, we have to change who's at the table. We have to change who's at the table in Congress. And we also, women have a very large stake in public safety. And I spend a lot of my days trying to recruit people to see themselves as prosecutors and police officers, probation officers, judges. So see me afterwards if you have any interest.
So let's
see me afterwards if you want to run for office.
So let's dive in a little bit to the culture piece about why it is that we still have these problems around domestic violence and sexual assault. You know, in many ways, we've seen a big change in the last year or so in this Me Too era, where women are coming forwards in droves, they're sharing stories they haven't shared maybe with anyone, maybe in decades. But yet, not that much seems to be changing. We haven't gotten that many convictions. The old power structures still seem to be in place. What is it that women can do? Do we have to sort of show our trauma to the world? Is that the only way that we can make change?
Well, you know, I think the Congresswoman is going to talk a little bit about how Me Too is different in some ways for the experience of domestic violence victims. But I will just say this, that there is a sense that when you're in the context of a relationship, there's still so much shame and such a lack of understanding this idea of why victims stay. And that there's some idea that in the context of a personal relationship, there might be something that I don't know, you know, talking about someone being sexually assaulted, you know, I can understand that that's bad, but maybe in the context of a domestic violence relationship, you know, maybe I don't know enough, you know, to make a judgment, and certainly not enough to show support on a, you know, on a social media platform like Twitter or Facebook. These are really complex, difficult issues. I will say, my fear, I have a very real fear as a result of what's happening culturally right now, is that the one thing that I know that works in healing the impacts of violence is accountability and not minimizing. The men that I've seen in court who plead guilty to an act of domestic violence, I can literally see it affect their body. You know, like you're at your table, the person is pleading guilty, and I'll never forget one day, it was relatively new in my career, and I could just see this man, when he was pleading guilty to an act of domestic violence and to hurting someone he loved, I could see it in his body. I saw something change, and I thought to myself, that guy, I have a belief that things might be different for him. He might be on the road to never doing that again, because this moment of reckoning, this moment of accountability could at least put him on the path with all the great programs that we have and the conversations that need to happen about why he did that. But in the age that we're in now, in the conversation, it seems as though deny, deny, deny. Nothing happened. They are lying. Women make things up. Women are liars. This, you know how it is, right? This unspoken thing that now people want to talk about actually is what's going to stop people who need to acknowledge the harm that they caused to get on track to never doing it again. So it's not just, is it going to affect how we are able to handle one case? And, you know, does Brett Kavanaugh benefit and get onto the Supreme Court? It's, what's the message? The message that we've learned over the last 20 years is, if you hurt someone, face it, right? Acknowledge it, don't minimize it, and you're on your way to maybe never doing it again. And that's what we want. We want to have healthy and safe relationships. And this national conversation that seems to suggest denial is the way and lock it down is actually incredibly harmful based on everything we know.
So there's two things that don't exist for domestic violence that you can argue do exist for the Me Too movement. One is, domestic violence has a stigma attached with it. And secondly, there isn't a public outrage because it's seen sometimes as private. There aren't any celebrities really that come forward and talk about the domestic violence they've suffered. I mean, Nicole Simpson was probably the most powerful victim. And then OJ got off. So I just wanted to read this because this is a DV survivor who wrote this on Facebook. She says, "I stayed because I was afraid he would hurt himself. I stayed because I thought he loved me. I stayed because I thought I could fix him. I stayed because I thought it was normal." So she posts this on Facebook, and she got a total of 5 likes. So when I look at the two issues, the one thing that has staying power is when you have something visual or auditory. In the case of Weinstein, it was that wire that woman was wearing, and you heard this pathetic, gross pleading that he went through. When Rob Porter was finally taken down in the White House, it was the photographs of his wife, one of his wives, I guess his wife and then his girlfriend, with a black eye. But it's almost like a woman is not to be believed unless you have tangible evidence. And that's pretty alarming, because a lot of times there isn't tangible evidence.
Yeah, it's tough. We're sort of encouraging women across society to come forward and share, but we're not providing them the support they need to have that result in change, or even just accountability. You know, last I heard, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford still can't go home, and Brett Kavanaugh got his seat on the Supreme Court. How do we make it easier for women to come forward?
Well, part of what we have to do is look at the gains, right? Where have we come? What works and what doesn't work? And we've got to fix that. So here in San Francisco, today is a really sad anniversary. 18 years ago, a beautiful young woman who was 28 years old, Claire Joyce Timpongo, was murdered in her home by her ex-boyfriend in front of her 5-year-old daughter and her 10-year-old son. Every system that was designed to save her failed her. And here in San Francisco, some really brave, incredible women, Andrea Shorter, Dr. Emily Morase, you know, looked at and created a what was called a courage and justice panel. And they said, we're going to unflinchingly look at what happened. Where was the ball dropped? She got protective orders, but the police didn't know. Adult probation, he was on probation after he'd murdered her. And after the murder had happened a couple days after, they said, you know, we should figure out where he is. This was days after he'd murdered her. And so at that time, the average number of women who were murdered in a domestic violence case in San Francisco was 10 to 12. Now a domestic violence murder one is an anomaly in a year, and the city and county of San Francisco went 40 consecutive months without a domestic violence homicide. Now, one is too many, right? But I think what that gives you hope, again, that when we start looking at these systems and with support of, you know, various folks who care about this issue and are unrelenting, you have to keep looking at, as this crime is changing, as our survivors are changing, as families are changing, what are our systems doing? The 911 callers, they are trained on how to talk to survivors. And one small issue is don't ask them if they need an ambulance, because they don't want their neighbors to see what's going on. Ask, you know, they're going to say, no, don't send an ambulance. The question is, do you need help? Are you hurt? So there are a million different things that we can do better that have actually helped us save lives. And so I think when we talk about, we have to balance it out. You know, there are some gains, but working together at the table over the long haul, we can actually protect women. We actually can mitigate harm. That the one time that, you know, this was a painful moment. I'm not going to lie. I sat at my table that Saturday morning and felt like I was punched in the gut, but the Saturday morning where he was confirmed. Not every Saturday morning I feel that way, just in case. I have lovely Saturday mornings watching soccer and all sorts of things. But, we as a movement have to hold on to our gains, because it reminds us that together we're stronger and we can actually do right by survivors and victims.
Let me return to the whole idea of getting more women elected to office and men who recognize the inequities that exist. You know, the year of the woman was 1992 on the heels of Anita Hill. I think that you're going to see a year of the women this year, because we have a record number of women running for Congress. There is 182 Democrats who are in general elections right now who are women. The highest number we ever had before was in 2014, I believe, and it was 120. And there are 56 Republican women running for Congress. So I do believe that more women at the table is going to make a huge difference. I also think that when we shine a spotlight on these issues, we start to see movement. We saw movement in terms of law enforcement looking differently at these situations after VAWA was passed. I mean, we're probably going to have to do a fair amount of research to help the electorate and those who are elected to public office realize that when women come forward, they are telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And that will, I think, change a lot of things. I remember when I was in the state legislature, and one of the bills I carried in terms of domestic violence, among many, was one on emergency orders. And at the time, emergency orders were only available Monday through Friday. When does most domestic violence occur? On the weekends. So that particular piece of legislation that became law created a means by which you could get an emergency order. So I think the more we can educate and the more we can get women at the table is going to make a huge difference.
Thank you. And Representative Speer, you recently came out with your own story of sexual violence. What was your thought process beforehand, and what happened as a result?
Well, I think like many of us, we compartmentalize bad experiences in our lives. And for me, I had compartmentalized it and actually did not even think about it until the Me Too movement took off. And I knew that we had a problem in Congress. And, you know, back in 2014, I tried to get a rule change that would require all members and staff to have sexual harassment training. And the chair of the Rules Committee sat with me on the House floor and looked at me and said, "Jackie, we will never do that." And I thought to myself, how am I going to take care of this? How am I going to do this? Well, the moment came, and so I thought, the best way to handle this is to do a short video, which I did, and it was two staff on the Hill saying, "I've been there. It happened to me." The chief of staff in my office when I was a staffer, when one night when everyone was gone, you know, threw me up against the wall, kissed me, stuck his tongue down my throat. And, you know, it's, what do? You're so astonished by the whole thing. You pushed him away, and I made a point of never being alone with him again. So I told the story so women would come forward. And did women come forward? Oh, my God. Unbelievable behavior.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
But what was really interesting was we got traction on the legislation in the House. When I was able to testify before the House Administration Committee and reference the fact that there were two seated members of the House presently that had sexual harassment complaints that had been filed, some of which had already been adjudicated, and they were still serving. That got people's attention. And of course, then the press came to me and wanted to know who they were. And I wouldn't tell them because it was for the victim to come forward. And I was going to protect the victim. But, I mean, sometimes you have to use personal experiences when the time is right to capture the moment. And that's what I did in that situation.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I have a question from the audience now that I think is really important to our understanding of culture as well. And it's about masculinity and what's going on with masculinity, with the examples we have of men in leadership and how we can do a better job of raising our boys so that they are less angry, more empathetic as they become men.
So I have a son.
I don't. So it's all you, Congresswoman.
I have a 30-year-old who, when the Me Too movement happened, and he was raised, obviously, in a very feminist household. I was a single parent for 8 years, and so he was the man in the house for a period of time. But I really think that he gets it. But he said something really interesting to me when the Me Too movement kind of took off. He said, "Well, I'm going to do a Pence." And I said, what are you talking about? He says, "Well, I'm never going to be in a room with a woman unless there's other people around." And that kind of bothered me.
Yeah.
So we've got to find a balance. I mean, men have got to feel comfortable having a conversation with a woman and saying, "Gee, that's, you know, a nice dress you have on," and recognize that that is not going to be taken as an offense. I've told many of my colleagues who've been smarting from the fact that they've got to take this training now. You know, think about what would you say to your mother? You would probably say to your mother, "That's a really pretty dress you have on, Mom." you would probably not say a number of other things that would probably be unwanted sexual advances.
My kids always say, "Are you going to wear that, Mom?" So maybe that's just my kids. Nicer. There is also, you guys should check out, if you're not already familiar with Futures Without Violence Coaching Boys into Men program. And Esta Soler talks about it in her TED Talk. I'll plug that too. It's 11 minutes. It's fantastic. It talks about sort of the history of the movement. But she uses this phrase that I thought was really interesting. She says, in the domestic violence conversation early on, men felt indicted, not invited. Those are completely her words that I borrowed. So, but I think that the idea was that, you know, violence in our society is not something that we're not going to solve it alone, that we need everybody in the conversation. And what they looked at was men were comfortable in the coaching context. And so there was a lot of partnership on how you use opportunities with young boys and men who are already coaching football or baseball as opportunities to talk about safe relationships and some of these issues that young men are facing. But I do think it's a critical component, and they've done really great work at Futures Without Violence.
Thank you. And, you know, I want to complicate it a little bit, because it's not just gender that we see around domestic violence. There's sort of a whole set of cultural factors. And we have this horrible history here in the US of not holding white men accountable for sexual assault. We see rates of convictions and charges less than for men of color. Mm-hmm. And we also have this history of falsifying accounts of sexual violence used to imprison or even kill black men, with perhaps the most famous case being Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. And so we have these sort of dual tracks for how we hold men accountable, depending on their race. And it makes it so much harder to create movements and to work across racial lines and racial groups, because we're sometimes dealing with really different narratives. I see a lot of fair skin up here between the three of us, but I think that makes us even more beholden to sort of speak out and talk about race and this injustice, and how do we acknowledge this history when we set up talking about solutions and movement buildings against these crimes.
Yeah, I absolutely think it's an important thing for us to talk about. So there are just some facts. African-American women are 2.5 times more likely to be murdered than white women. ICE and the fear of deportation has long been a tactic of abusers to scare women who, whether they are documented or not, that there's some work that can be done with ICE to take them away, deport them or their children, separate their children from them. One of the big findings of the Courage and Justice panel here in San Francisco was that of the 10 to 12 murder victims who had been killed as a result of domestic violence in the city, 70% of them were immigrants who had limited English skills. And so I think that this is a really tough thing for some people, but it's actually pretty simple. Domestic violence happens to everyone. It happens in all families. It happens across every spectrum you can imagine: religion, sexual orientation, every color, every creed. But the impact and the vulnerability that certain women face as a result of dealing with racism, dealing with the fact that maybe I don't feel comfortable, maybe in where, based on my experience, I don't feel comfortable calling the police. I don't feel like they're there to serve me. So I've now got an additional disadvantage that another woman who feels comfortable on her best day calling the police doesn't have. Then you've got poverty. And while a woman of means might still also, her abuser might be keeping all the money from her. So, you know, we don't want to simply say she could leave if she wanted to, because that dynamic isn't at play. But, you know, if you're living in poverty and experiencing that, you know, the idea that you're going to be able to deal with all that comes from being in an abusive relationship certainly is an additional factor. And then, look, I mean, some of the great organizers around this movement, including Beverly Upton and the Domestic Violence Consortium here in San Francisco, have been talking about immigration for a decade. The idea that looking at the impacts of the immigration system and separating families, and what is the role of separating it out and saying, you know, enforcing immigration laws is really the province of the federal government, but local and state law enforcement, in order to serve victims and have them be a place where you feel comfortable coming forward, need to be clear that that is not what we're here to do. Your status in this country is not what matters to me. Your safety is what matters to me. Your family is what matters to me. That is someone else's job, and there's a lot of misunderstanding around sanctuary city, but fundamentally it is that in order for the primary law enforcement responder to meet victims and survivors and witnesses where they are, they have to say, that is not my concern. My concern is, how can I help you? How can I make you safe? And so I think we can't have this conversation without acknowledging that community-based support that looks, that represents every community. One of the things that came out of the Clara Choice Tempango murder was the Filipino American community really faced and has done a lot of organizing around, we didn't think this happened to our community. And it came from that community then saying, we have to work in our community and with our community to address this. So I think we have to have many doors to all survivors and women and their experience, and recognize that the impact can be much more challenging based on the other structural disadvantages that you face.
You know, elections have consequences. You've heard that a lot. And let me just give you two examples. This is kind of focused on the immigrant population. And I agree with everything that you said, Susie. In 2014, there was an immigration appeals case that came forward. It was a woman from Guatemala who had acid burns and who was punched in the stomach when she was pregnant. The baby was born with bruises, and the appeals court determined that she was in a social group, so all women from Guatemala who were in this social group being victims of domestic violence would have the right to seek asylum in the United States. Another case that came out in 2016 was of an El Salvadorian woman, similar sets of circumstances. When it came up to the Immigration Appeals Court, the Attorney General of this country, Jeff Sessions, has the authority to pull the case and reversed it. So there is now a real question in this country as to whether a woman seeking asylum for domestic violence purposes who submits herself to Border Patrol agents would even be admitted for the purposes of having an asylum hearing because of this decision. So, you know, that's something to ponder. I think as we look at race generally, there is a growing awareness that justice has not been equal. The bail system is now being looked at for that same reason. We know that there are far more persons of color who are serving time for minor drug offenses than there are whites. And the good news there is that regardless of party, we are recognizing that there is an inequity that needs to be addressed. And you've got the Koch brothers who look at it from a financial standpoint. I mean, I'll take it any way I can get it. But, you know, they recognize that having a lot of these people in prison for minor offenses doesn't make a lot of sense financially. And so they've gotten the support of people like Rand Paul on the Senate side. So I think we're going to see more movement in that regard.
Yeah, we need some big changes to really address domestic violence and sexual assault. We've talked some about the changes we need in our culture, but we also need changes in our systems. You know, I think a lot of people think of domestic violence as a personal problem, but it's also a public health crisis. And it's a problem that affects the people at large. The first system I want to look at is the criminal justice system. We know that there are racial inequities, that justice hasn't been equal, and that it's very hard for women to come forward and survivors of all genders to come forward. Many of these cases never make it to the courtrooms. What changes do we need to make the remedy of the criminal justice system more accessible to survivors?
Well, I have some very practical things. I mean, I think these cases need to be what's called vertically prosecuted. So that means that you have one person to deal with. You've got one prosecutor. I'm Susie. I'm the person who calls you every week. You have a victim advocate. We know more about the lethality of these crimes, and I think it's the stats from the California crime in California. It just came out, and so 8% of the homicides in California still are domestic violence related. So, like, we've so many miles to go before we sleep. And one of the tools that is getting a lot of attention, again, being advocated for by incredible warrior women at the grassroots level, are in partnership with academics, but lethality assessments, right? How do we take the science and the data about what we know, and where there are certain factors we can see that a woman in a particular call is in a particularly dangerous situation, right? Of this becoming a lethal situation. And so I'm a big fan of dedicated units with sufficient prosecutors, sufficient victim advocates, and the resources that you need so that, you know, in the nature of a prosecutor's office, it's, you can imagine, it's not like it is on TV, you guys, you know? It's like, you know, crimes aren't solved in 1 hour by incredibly attractive people. I mean, no disrespect to my colleagues and former colleagues, but, you know, you can have you can have one felony attorney with 100 felony cases, right? And so, you know, when something feels like a mill, right, which sometimes it can, and if it's, you know, if it's low-level drug cases or it's that type of thing, but you've got a woman who, again, is in the worst moment of her life, a woman or a man. Again, I had victims that were of both gender, though it's overwhelmingly, based on statistics, women. You need to be able to have a system that is not, as I said, on its best day, known to be particularly user-friendly. I always say the criminal justice system is a misnomer because it implies that it's a system, right, where we work together and we're all here to serve you. If you happen to end up having to interact with the criminal justice system, you're like, this is what happens? You know, if it's nobody called me back or I don't know where to go, and then let alone imagining preparing to testify against someone you love, knowing that you don't even control what the outcome is, right, at the end of it, and then you have to be cross-examined. So I think we have to do better by each victim who comes through our system. And part of that is seeing and recognizing, and I have tremendous respect for many of the prosecutors that are still doing this work, that their growing understanding of how, when it comes to these particular types of crimes, we have to be present, we have to connect with survivors, and we have to make sure that the system serves them all the way through, because each woman also represents a network of other women, and they're incredibly connected. So I'm a believer that every case that we handle appropriately, every victim and survivor that we treat with dignity, is going to encourage the next person to say, you know what, I actually went through this process, and let me tell you how it can possibly work out, that there, it's not all, you know, the horror stories that you hear. So
thank you for that. You know, we've seen some success in the policy front, from the Violence Against Women Act to California's own affirmative assent laws. What is the next set of legislation that we need?
Well, I would say that we need to find a way to limit the trauma that a victim goes through when they come forward. Having to tell your story over and over again, I think, is part of it. I think education, more training is really important. Let me give you an example where it was made pretty obvious in San Mateo County recently. We created a zero tolerance for sex trafficking in San Mateo County. And I brought together all of law enforcement, the FBI, the U.S. attorney. We trained the hotel staffs. We trained people at the airports. And after all of that took place, one of the DAs said to me, you know, I never put together the fact that this one man had domestic violence charges made by two different women. And then he realized that not only was he a perpetrator of domestic violence, he was a sex trafficker. And so it was a great example of how training is a huge component.
That's right.
And we need to find ways of mandating more of that too.
I also spent 2 years working with someone you might be familiar with, Dr. Nadine Burke Harris, who's done really landmark work on expanding the understanding of adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress. After serving for a long time as a prosecutor, both at the local and state level, you know, it was clear to me that the criminal justice system and arresting and prosecuting people alone wasn't going to solve some of the underlying issues. And so working in and with the community, my colleague Cecilia Chen is here from our work out in Bayview, and it really is this idea that in childhood, what happens to you can have lasting consequences to your overall health, increased risk of heart disease, liver cancer, everything, but also engaging in high-risk behavior, likelihood of being a victim. So things like incarceration of a parent, emotional or physical neglect, divorce. The most common is verbal abuse. But, you know, 67% of people in California have at least one adverse childhood experience. And I think it's about 16% have at least four. And when you have at least four, your risk of engaging in high-risk sexual behaviors, your risk of heart disease, it all goes off the map, right? You kind of inherently, you go, okay, that makes sense if bad things happen to you in childhood. And so, you know, part of what we have to do is look at root causes, move all this way upstream, right? And it's unusual for me as, you know, the law enforcement person and the prosecutor to say, like, it all needs to start way before you're ever talking about me. And I think, you know, in Bayview, we had one young patient. I'll never forget him. His name was Michael. He was in foster care, this beautiful young boy. And he'd seen three homicides by the time he was 6 years old. So what I can't abide, and this is just really what I can't do anymore, is I can't act like without some intervention, we know what's going to happen to Michael. Like, let's just quit playing. You know, like, violence is this incredibly destructive force, and there's this beautiful child with all this promise. And we kind of like, well, I don't know, what are we going to do? You know, there are things that can be done, and there's exciting work that's being looked at, but it's screening in the pediatric home, it's support systems for that foster mom, you know, and we really have to invest a lot earlier in childhood, and a lot of that looks like supporting moms and supporting families and getting people out of poverty, which is something that I think people are talking about now, and addressing the impact of intergenerational trauma. But in terms of what we need to do, I think legislatively, one of the things the California legislature did that I think was exciting is starting to track the data and look, you know, even when we're looking at that time and we're measuring it, I think that's an important start.
I'd also add that, you know, we finally took the statute of limitation away from rape up until very recently. It was a 10-year statute of limitation on rape. And I remember when I was still in the state legislature carrying a bill thinking, we now have DNA. Why would we not lift the statute of limitations? Because you have a means by which you can prove. So that's happened. But, you know, there's been a number of cases of law enforcement having sex with victims. And the argument has been, well, they consented. It's a lot like in the military system where, you know, a military training instructor has sex with a trainee and it's consensual. But in those situations, there's just the power discrepancy is so great that you can't say that consent is allowed. You've got to somehow create a strict liability. So we've done that with military training instructors. I have a bill that's going to not allow consent to be a defense with law enforcement officers. So that's another area where I think we can start improving.
You know, one of the places that I'm hopeful about on the policy and legislative front is, as you mentioned, the sort of year of the women, right? We're seeing more women running for office than ever before, and not just running for office, organizing on the ground and maybe even voting. What do you think is the potential, the power of this women's political activation?
Huge. You know, I'll just say that when I got elected to the state legislature, my campaign consultant said, you know, you've got to stop being kind of focused on women's issues. Because I had spent a lot of time on that issue when I was on the Board of Supervisors. And so I sort of listened to him for a while. And then I thought to myself, well, if I'm not going to take on these issues, who is? And so it became my passion for virtually the whole time I was in the state legislature. And we did a lot of work on child support enforcement, which was really abysmal. And the feminization of poverty had a lot to do with the fact that when divorce took place, the woman's status dropped dramatically and the man's status went up considerably because there wasn't the enforcement of child support. And so oftentimes, even though you had a court order, child support was not being enforced. So one of the bills I carried was one that basically said if you had a license, any kind of license in California, and didn't pay your child support, you could lose your license. So the first person that got caught was a San Diego physician who hadn't paid $100,000 of child support. And he got serious about repaying the child support when he was about to lose his license. One of the more humorous cases was a beekeeper who was about to lose his beekeeper's license. And he didn't much care about his beekeeper's license. But when they were going to put a lien against his Harley, he got serious about repaying his child support, too. So, I mean, yes, I think having women at the table is going to make a huge, huge difference.
One of the jobs you have to do when you're on the police commission is it's in closed session where you actually are the quasi-judicial officer in discipline hearings against police officers who are accused of misconduct. So your job is to take the evidence and then ultimately decide, did that happen? And then what's the consequence, right? What's the punishment? And I knew there was sort of a culture change because early on when I got on the commission, again, this all happens based on state law, it's changing, but it's done in what's called closed session. So you guys don't see that part. And there was an allegation of an officer who had committed misconduct with a 15-year-old girl who he coached, you know? And I got to tell you guys, I mean, you're not going to believe. I'll take you there with me. We're sitting in the hearing. It was a lawyer. It was a really smart woman who was defending him. And she just was like, you know, girls, you know, 15-year-old girls. Well, he's not going to coach again, you know? And I was literally like, I mean, I was pretty new on the commission. I was like, I was looking around, like, does this work? Like, you do what works, right? Advocates and people do what works. And this idea that we can just say, like, there was the girl, it was the girl's fault that he was calling her at 2 a.m, you know, and telling her that I won't go into the details in case you can figure out who it was, because that would violate law. But let's leave it to this. The word got out, like, that dog doesn't hunt anymore, you know? Don't bring defense of misconduct against young women as victim blaming, because that's not going to get you what you want from this commission. And so I think that goes to what the Congresswoman is saying is, you know, we really have to understand why someone is sitting in that chair and why it matters, because your lived experience matters. The lived experience of women and daughters and aunts and sisters and friends and people who've helped a woman get out of this, like having all of those experiences is what you bring to the position. And in that, to the point, if 80% of the folks who've been making these decisions look a certain way and have had a certain lived experience, they're making decisions based on that. And we absolutely have to change the game. And it did change. And the arguments were no longer, you know how girls are, because it didn't work anymore.
That's such important work. And I feel like we've talked a lot about how to change systems, but we also need to make changes on our personal level, right? Like we all have this role in creating and living in this culture that makes light of abuse, that excuses it. And I want to talk about what we can do in our day-to-day lives to challenge our culture of violence. I'm really big on using our consumer powers for good and making sure, for instance, that the media that you consume isn't glamorizing domestic violence, that you're talking back to advertisers and saying, hey, don't use this type of imagery. What are the things that you've seen that work in terms of having these conversations with your friends and your family members and your social media followers? What is making the change on that kind of person-to-person level?
I've
I have a good story on this one. So my daughter and I were walking into Macy's at Stonestown, and I don't know if it's there anymore, but the world is changing. But within the last year, we walked into Macy's at Stonestown, and you know the security beeper thing? It went off. We were entering, and the security guy goes, "You're fine. Go in." And I was like, "So Maureen, so I just want to talk about what happened just there, which is the assumption was made that that we didn't do anything wrong, you know." And she goes, I know, Mom. It's implicit bias. It's white privilege." She goes, I know. It's implicit bias and white privilege, and that likely wouldn't have happened to somebody else." And I was like, "Oh, yeah." I mean, she's a teenager still, right? So she can't give me an inch. But I think that certainly raising my kids are young white girls, and I do think that this politics of now also requires how you live your life and how I raise my children and what we talk about, and that the realities of, you know, everything from implicit bias to explicit bias and how people walk in the world is something that the political is very personal to me, and that's one of the ways that it showed up recently.
I would say that I think corporate America is becoming much more sensitized to this issue. And they are concerned about making sure that we continue to be consumers that recognize their brands as being, stellar. The number of domestic violence cases that occurs after the Super Bowl is staggering. Mm. And so there was this whole effort by a lot of the advertisers during the Super Bowl to have really profound and provocative advertising that I thought was a step in the right direction. So I think that's really important. I think we really just have to be willing to speak up and use our voices. The fact that a domestic violence survivor feels reluctant to come forward and a Me Too sexual harassment survivor does is something that we've got to address. And we've got to be more open to listening to those voices, I think, generally.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is a question from the audience, and I think it's a nice one to start to wind down our discussion, which is, what does equality even look like? Can we imagine what that world is? How, you know, what's the role of male allies in taking more responsibility in this public health crisis? And how do we create a vision that we all can share and work towards together?
I love that question because I feel like it's so rarely asked. We know what we don't want, but when we're pressed on what we do want, you know, we have to paint the picture. It's another way that we invite people in, right? And so I think in terms of, I have this conversation a lot in the context of safety. I believe that we want to live in safe and healthy places to, you know, live, play, and work, to raise our families. I think there is so much more that unites us than divides us. And safety is not the province of a few. It's something that we all want. And I think that's why, and I think this is the part where we're supposed to be hopeful. So I'm gonna say something that's not
You are
that
supposed
hopeful.
To be hopeful.
I'm supposed to be hopeful now, but I will say this in terms of what we need to work on. I think the Congresswoman focused on this, but I was just looking at the co-sponsorship of the Reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which will come up again in December. It was kicked until then. It's like 173 co-sponsors, but none of them are Republican. And so I think this question of what world do we want to create is also the opportunity for us to remind everyone that while we might have partisan divisions on a number of different things, we should all be united on wanting to create safe and healthy neighborhoods for us to live and grow and raise our families. And so I think that idea that we, you know, while we're having the partisan battles, we've got to step back and say that, you know, we often want the same thing when it comes to safety. We don't want our women, our daughters, our sons to be in violent relationships, and that there's so much more that we can do.
So my bit of hopefulness is millennials. Hmm. I think they get it a whole lot better than the baby boomers. I mean, imagine that Senate committee room with all the senators being millennials. What do you think the vote would have been there? So I actually think that as more millennials are in positions of power in this country, I mean, issues like marriage equality, we couldn't pass a marriage equality bill if our life depended on it right now. But for the courts, marriage equality would not be a reality in this country.
That's right.
But the millennial population says, what is the big deal here? So I'm hopeful because millennials are going to take over this country, and I'm going to be there to say, bravo!
Thank you so much. In closing, I want to say, if you or someone you know is experiencing abuse, know that you are not alone and there is hope. Check out the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233 for a place to get started. Our thanks to Jackie Speier, Congresswoman of California's 14th District, and Susie Loftus, former president of the San Francisco Police Commission, for joining us this evening. Would also like to thank the Blue Shield of California Foundation for generously supporting this program. As a reminder, there will be a reception in the room behind us, and you are all welcome to attend. I am Christina Escobar, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.